and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Trump administration says it will further sanction Russia only after the EU stops importing Russian energy. Clearly, this is a near impossible demand, and it's intentional. Essentially, Trump is saying, you first when it comes to Ukraine. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest Larry Johnson in Tampa. He's a former CIA analyst and U.S. State Department counterterrorism official. In Plymouth, we have Patrick Henningsen. He is the editor and founder of 21st Century Wire. And in Germany, we cross to Konstantin von Hofmeister. He is the author of the books Esoteric Trumpism and Multipolarity, as well as founder and director of Multipolar Press. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Larry, let me go to you first here. I'm calling this program Trump's Double Cross. And maybe for a change, this is not a bad strategy when it comes to Trump. And I'm going to, rabbit hole it into this specific category, Ukraine. But, I mean, he's basically mousetrapped them. Okay, you want sanctions? Okay, well, I'm all up for it. I mean, you first. You go first. And it's an impossible demand. We know it. Is this a good strategy, Larry?
Well, it has turned out to be a good strategy. Originally, I thought Trump had sort of painted himself into a corner with his threats to impose sanctions, implying that the United States would go first. But then when he, flipped the script and said, Europe, you got to do it. Europe, once you do it, then we're with you 100%, 1,000%. But Europe's going, well, wait a second. No. We want you to do it. So all of a sudden, it's created this stalemate between the United States and Europe, with neither side doing anything but a lot of talk. There's still some aid flowing, and the Brits and the French continue to send some mercenaries and officers in to assist, and they're getting killed. But as far as the entire concept of sanctioning Russia, what's left to do?
Yeah.
I mean, they've sanctioned everything except maybe toilet paper.
Well, as I like to point out in this program, if you're not an avid consumer of news, and let's face it, most people around the world are not stuck on their phones like we are, but most Russians don't even really feel that the country is even sanctioned at all. Patrick, what is happening here? It seems to me, if you look at the media coverage of what I call the Ukraine project, what you read about is the bickering among NATO countries. It has almost nothing to do with Russia anymore, or even Ukraine. Patrick.
Well, I think the Trump administration or the United States has conveniently passed the ball over into the laps of the Europeans in so many different ways. And not to say that the U.S. has completely extricated itself from Ukraine, from Europe, from NATO. I don't think that's the case. But for the next 3 years, to the duration of this presidency, this is definitely the politically expedient, at least the public facing a policy, or at least the veneer of it anyway. The bottom line is that Europe is in an economic hole right now. They're not going to get out unless they start rapprochement with the East, with Russia. And instead, they're playing games with India right now. They're holding up a major trade deal, the EU, because of the so-called relationship or ties with Moscow. And that secondary sanctions, that's pressure coming from the U.S. And in a way, this works out perfectly for Trump, because he can just, this kind of fake quid pro quo, well, the Europeans have got to take care of this first, and then we'll be there to back them up, but they've got to move first, and they're not going to move. The Europeans don't have any moves left. So this is just perfectly convenient from a political point of view, and he can just step back. And meanwhile, I think the real winners, of course, are the defense industry and the military-industrial complex. They haven't lost a foot in this whole drama, and they'll continue to gain strength in their industry as they remilitarize and move the Iron Curtain, as it were, although we're on the wrong side of it at this point, moving it further east.
Well, Constantine, do the Europeans have the wherewithal to take up Trump's demand? I mean, as I said in my introduction, this is a near impossibility. Slovakia and Hungary simply cannot do it. And I think it was very interesting if you read the Truth Social tweet that Trump sent out days ago. He didn't say Europe. He didn't say the EU, he said NATO, which is very important because obviously that includes Turkey. The Turks are not going to do this for the European Union, not for Trump, not for anybody. I mean, this was an intentional blockade or challenge that Trump has presented the Europeans.
Yeah, I think the United States actually wants peace with Russia. It is in the interest of the United States, and I think Trump is quite sincere about it. And I think the administration is quite disappointed with the European Union's constant obstructions, because you had the meeting in Alaska, and they probably made some headway, but then immediately afterwards, you had the European Union leaders basically trying to throw a wrench into the whole process. Mm. So I think Trump is making this demand because he knows it is virtually impossible. But I wouldn't say it's completely impossible. I mean, Germany, for example, already stopped getting Russian gas and oil directly from Russia. It also shut down its own nuclear power plants almost at the same time, thereby ruining its industry. And why is Germany doing this? Well, I think a lot of people know that Germany is not a sovereign country. It's basically a vassal state of the United States. Okay. And I think the entire European Union is basically not a sovereign pole in the new multipolar world because it cannot defend itself. It does not have the strength to be its own pole. It's completely dependent on the United States for defense. And also, ideologically, I think the European Union is now going its own way. Because in the United States, I think you can witness a sort of paradigm shift.
Well, I mean, Constantine, let's stay with that thought. I mean, can the Europeans, and we'll use the in the context of the EU, can it go its own way? Does it have the resources, the wherewithal? Does it have the intellectual power to do it? And I mean that politically, Constantine.
Yeah, I don't think it does, because I think if you look at as an ideological map, the United States before Trump was basically the headquarters of wokeism and liberalism. But I think that has changed. And I think the United States is now moving decidedly into a more conservative direction. So I think the headquarters of wokeism and liberalism has basically shifted from the United States to the European Union, with Germany as its headquarters being the most powerful player in the EU. But at the same time, Germany knows very well that it cannot act alone because it is still under control of Washington, basically. So it still has to do Washington's bidding. I mean, Seymour Hersh wrote a famous piece about Nord Stream 2, yeah, which was basically blown up by the Americans to destroy the European economy for the benefit of the United States, obviously, because there was always
So here we go again, right? Larry, what does this have to do with Ukraine? We're not even, Ukraine barely makes it into the conversation we're talking about this. Larry.
Yeah, well, I guess just today I saw the announcement that they made another exchange of bodies of dead soldiers. Once again, Russia turns over 1,000 Ukrainians, mm-hmm, and the Russians received, I think today, is 29. Now, completely cuts against the meme that's been pushed by Keith Kellogg, who recently, as Sunday was saying, "Oh yeah, well, hey, Russia's losing. They're taking." Millions of casualties.
Larry, I don't know what they're putting in his cornflakes. I really don't.
But so you, against that backdrop, you have a level of political chaos in Europe that, frankly, I think is, we haven't seen in recent history in the last 100 years. Keir Starmer, he's about as popular as getting a colonoscopy. Macron in France is equally unpopular and has been shredded. And then the Lucy show in Germany with Desi Arnaz and Fred Mertz. know, for your non-English speakers or people not familiar with American culture, there was a character on the I Love Lucy show named Fred Mertz. But that one, he was lovable and entertaining. This guy that's running Germany is just a nightmare.
Let me go to Constantine on this, because Mertz has found himself in a very peculiar position. He's the most belligerent chancellor of Germany since Adolf Hitler. I mean, that's an interesting group to be mentioned in. Go ahead, Constantine.
Well, there's a huge double standard in German politics, because Germany always attacks Russia through the establishment media by saying it's, I don't know, committing genocide in Ukraine and other such nonsense, obviously. But at the same time, when Israel kills scores of civilians in Gaza, there's not a peep, basically. And you're absolutely right. It's a completely belligerent chancellor. And I think it is ideological. They actually believe their own narrative. So I think it's all connected, like foreign policy, what's going on in Ukraine.
On this program, you bring up so many interesting points. Why can't they entertain an alternative? Why are they so captured? They're prisoners of their own ideology. And all of us in this program know what direction Europe and Germany is going. Why can't they break through that and say, we need a reassessment? What's blocking them from doing that?
Well, it's precisely they've internalized this woke liberal ideology, and I actually believe that they sincerely want to follow it through to the very end, and they cannot change, because I mean this process I think has been going on for decades, and I think in the European Union and Western Europe it is much worse than in the United States, because in the United States you have at least half the population that is conservative. Because Trump got elected, I mean, you don't have the same percentage in Germany. I mean, even if you have the AfD at like 27% now, according to the latest polls, which means 73% are opposed to the AfD. I mean, it's not even half. It's like a quarter maybe. So, and the ideology is basically hardcore liberalism, hardcore wokeism, and any enemy to this ideology has to be defeated in their eyes, and they do the same domestically when they're now talking about.
So the only way we can break out of this is when they utterly fail, and that's what it looks like is happening to me. Gentlemen, I have to jump in. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Larry. Let's change the script a little bit. Speaking of scripts, Mr. Zelensky seems to be sticking to his. In a recent interview, I think, in the last news cycle, he said that he's saying that the West should put Ukraine's interests first. Well, it's really quite amazing, considering, and I don't want to go into what's going on in the United States, because that's just, we'll be talking until we're all blue in the face. But there's a lot happening, let's put it that way. And it's a big debate about America first. And then we had, in London, we had Unite the Kingdom demonstration, which the authorities underestimated its size grossly. Very strong UK first agenda. And then the AfD has just come out and saying they need a Germany first here. But nonetheless, Mr. Zelensky is saying everybody should put Ukraine first. Well, if he had put Ukraine first, would this conflict never would have happened? Larry.
Yeah, the fact that the Ukrainian people don't appreciate or understand, they're just a tool. They're a pawn of the West, particularly of the United States. You know, really going back since 1995, Ukraine's been a de facto member of NATO, and they've always been including it as a de facto member of NATO for the express purpose of destroying Russia. You know, that has been, it's been written about by various think tanks, RAND Corporation, the most notable, in 2019 with its paper, you know, extending Russia. Within this, there's not a damn bit of concern for the Ukrainian people. And, you know, we don't care if they die. We don't care if they're destroyed. Just as long as they are being able to be used by us to accomplish what we want in the West. I mean, it's beyond cynical. It's an evil, evil policy.
You know, Patrick, I've over the last few weeks watching events unfold, you know, having buffoons like Kellogg talking and whatnot. I mean, it's really disgraceful, and it's really disgraceful for the men that are dying in the battlefield. But it seems to me the Trump administration, maybe just Trump, who knows, he's willing to watch this military conflict come to its end. They keep talking about negotiations, ceasefires. None of this is going to happen. The outcome will happen on the battlefield. And meanwhile, you have the Zelensky crew just cutting the checks, cashing the checks, and when it's the time is right for them, they will make their escape if they can, okay? This is probably the most cynical conflict I've seen in my lifetime. Go ahead, Patrick.
Firstly, I don't believe personally, you know, just having watched Donald Trump and studied his every word, especially the last 7, 8, 9 months, you know, he might say one thing, he might posture one way right now, and then he can very easily flip in another direction in 24 hours or a week or something like that, depending on what the blob around him is pushing him to do. And this is the problem. He's not a very strong leader as an individual, although he puts up a big front as a personality. He's very weak, and his weakness is predicated on his lack of intellectual capability to understand history, to understand the nuances of this conflict, including Steve Witkoff, his real estate pal, who couldn't even name the Donbass territories when he was on Tucker Carlson doing that big flagship interview. And it's beyond embarrassing at that point. So this idea that Trump wants peace, he might want peace, but can he get to peace? Trump talks the talk, but he doesn't walk the walk. I don't see really clear policy changes, even after Alaska. I don't see a lot. What I do see, however, I do see a lot of maneuvering with regards to these drone false flag pseudo attacks with Poland, Romania, and also Moldova. The elections are coming up. I think this is going to be a big play from France. Macron seems to be running point. The British have also had Maya Sandu in Britain with an official state visit recently. She's probably been giving her instructions there. They would love to pull Ukraine into Transnistria to create another front, to demand more money, more weapons from the U.S. And at that point, Donald Trump will cave. He will absolutely cave and go with whatever the inertia is going with, because what he's proven in his career is if the media and the political elites in Europe and everybody in the United States, the Lindsey Grahams of the world, if all of that full court press comes on Trump, he will capitulate and he will go down a policy of escalation or continue the conflict. And for the British are very cynical, as well as the Europeans. They believe that with enough time, the new drone tech, new AI tech, all these revolutions in military affairs, that they'll be able to destabilize this theater and Russia too.
We've seen this before. It was in the fall of 1944 and the spring of 1945.
They just want to keep it going.
Right. Wonder weapons are going to save the day here. You know, Constantine, again, you know, one of the most perplexing elements of this entire a conflict that never should have happened in the first place is the behavior of the Europeans. The Europeans are willing to risk their relationship with the United States, with China, with India, obviously with Russia, for Ukraine. Explain that to me. Or is it part of your first answer? This is just ideological.
Well, it is part of the first answer, and it is ideological because they sincerely believe that Ukraine is like a true democracy and Russia is some kind of evil dictatorship. This is the narrative that they are pushing. And like I said, they're pushing it domestically as well. And not just Germany, but I think the entire EU. And they think all means are fair in the fight against what they perceive as some kind of rising authoritarianism that threatens liberal democracy. I mean, we saw it in Romania when they basically canceled the elections because Ceausescu was going to win.
Aren't they becoming exactly what they claim Russia to be? They become authoritarians themselves. Okay, I'm glad you mentioned Romania. They just canceled the election. If Moldova doesn't work out, they're going to cancel that too. Okay,
of course,
they won't let Le Pen run, and who knows if AfD is going to be shut down. I mean, these people are, you know, these are Democrats with a small D. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say they just had a mayoral election in the city of Ludwigshafen in Germany, and the AfD polled first place in this particular city, I think at like 27%, and they basically banned the AfD candidate from running in the election because he said what they argued were, I don't know, anti-constitutional extremist rhetoric, basically. It's all nonsense, of course. It's all made up because they are threatened by the AfD. So they're using lawfare, basically, to combat the AfD, just as they're using warfare in Ukraine to combat what they perceive as an authoritarian threat against the liberal order. Because anything that is conservative or, I don't know, reeks of traditionalism for them has to be fought against. So I think the front line for the liberal EU is quite clear inside the EU and outside the EU. So I don't think they view the United States as a reliable partner anymore, precisely because it has moved in the more conservative direction. And that's why they're trying to obstruct all kinds of efforts that the United States has made towards peace. And I think they sincerely view Ukraine as a proper democracy, even though it's not. But they think it is sort of in league with them and belongs to the club of liberalism,
Yeah, well,
basically.
because they don't question Ukraine's democratic credentials because they don't want to look at their own. Okay, Larry, it was just mentioned here from Constantine. Very good observation. Is Donald Trump a reliable partner?
Oh, heavens no.
Heavens no.
Just ask Hamas. We've seen this pattern, that we've seen emerge where Donald Trump will offer, peace talks and support peace talks that are used basically as bait to lure the other trusting country into a trap. Or, we saw it with, in fact, with the attacks that took place in Russia on June 1st, where, they're supposed to be sitting down for peace talks in Istanbul, I guess, like on a Monday, and then on a Saturday, the drone attacks on the strategic air bases are launched. And anyone that thinks that that was just, Ukraine or no. The United States, at a minimum, from my old outfit, the CIA was involved with that, and it's become a pattern. So Trump is not reliable, and I really don't think Trump's calling the shots. I mean, he likes to think he's in charge, leading the parade. It's akin to that thing that, maybe you experienced that as a child, when your father would let you sit on his lap in the car and pretend that you were driving the car, but actually you didn't. You couldn't reach the brakes or the accelerator. That was under his control.
That's a very good analogy. Patrick, it seems to me, and we're going a little adrift here, but it seems to me that Trump is mimicking the Israelis, almost. Very brutal. They don't believe in negotiations. They don't believe in diplomacy. Blow up the boat if you see it off of Venezuela. Trump obviously knew that Doha was going to be bombed, or if he didn't know, it's the same difference, the same problem here, Patrick.
I don't think it's a case of Trump mimicking the Israelis. Look at his team, from the Secretary of State to his National Security Advisor, same person, or the de facto Secretary of State, Witkoff, or everybody. Every single person, is what we've learned, is that every single person that had anything to do with national security or foreign policy was hand-selected and shortlisted by the Israeli lobby, including interventions by Miriam Adelson, Benjamin Netanyahu, and others. So everybody that's staffed there for foreign policy is staffed for Israel. So, Russia, Ukraine, that's a side hustle for Steve Witkoff. That's not the focus. So they're all focused on Israel and what's good for Israel, and not so they're out of their depth when it comes to Eurasia and some of these big geopolitical questions
Well,
regarding
Patrick,
Ukraine and Russia.
I've posited that they've just farmed out the Middle East to Israel. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, Israel is running U.S. Middle East policy without a doubt. So they have effectively farmed it out. But that's the problem with allowing a foreign lobby to select your cabinet, is because that's only in the interest of that foreign lobby. And all of the other theaters, be they South America, be they the Far East and the Pacific, or, you know, be they Russia, Ukraine, all important geopolitical theaters for the United States, and they're completely out of their depth. They don't have the capabilities on staff to deal with these situations, certainly nothing close to previous administrations. And that's a huge problem for America. Again, sacrificing all of this for one tiny little country in the Middle East.
Well, that's why, gentlemen, last week I made a program, and I'm going to probably have to make additional parts to it, with the age of barbarism, because that's where we are, the age of barbarism again. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Tampa, Plymouth, and in Germany. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.